You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 29th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jamie Martin, assistant professor of history at Harvard University, author of The Meddlers, Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Economic Global Governance. Also on the program today, UN to send inspectors to Ukrainian nuclear plant amid fighting around the plant. The DOJ affidavit says that Trump's stolen documents could compromise some human intelligence. Meanwhile, one third of Pakistan has been flooded, millions displaced, thousands, at least a thousand, dead. Polls showing broad approval for Biden's student debt relief, though there is a significant number that want more. Speaking of polls, polls are showing a Republican gains in the House may not be quite as large as they had anticipated. Part of that is Republican Senate candidates are in disarray as North Carolina and Florida come into play. Fed chair signals more interest rate hikes in a bid to discipline labor. Portland's Verizon unionizes. The Chateau Marmont unionizes.
Oh, oui, oui, oui.
Well, not really, but Major League Baseball minor leagues seek to unionize, and Chipotle in Lansing, Michigan, has now unionized. There's only so many Chipotles they can close after they get unionized, folks. And lastly, free COVID tests from the government end on Friday. Take a minute right now. Go get yourself 8 free. And new COVID boosters are set for approval this week by the FDA. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am back from vacation.
Tanned and happy.
Tanned and happy, much to the delight, I hope.
Yeah.
Of Emma Vigeland, who is here, of course.
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm delighted that you're tan, but it's...
Well, I'm not saying I'm saying you're delighted that I'm tan, but that I'm back.
No, I am. I am. I will say my brain fog is still a thing.
Okay. All right.
I mentioned this probably at the start of every show to couch it.
Prepare the excuse.
Yeah. So you having you back definitely takes some pressure off. In that situation.
That's a very sweet thing for you to say.
Yeah.
Thank you, Emma. That is very kind.
Right.
Yes, that is really, wow.
Otherwise, it's a wash.
So nice to be back with such sweet words. I was so missed.
Yes,
I am slightly taking off the pressure off you. Well, okay, glad to hear that.
Yeah, of course.
Let's get right into it, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, there was a lot of news last week because I was off. On vacation.
Mm-hmm. That's how it works around
yep.
here.
I was out getting a little sun, and of course, my annual bout with eczema all under my arms. So, yep, there we
need
go.
Need that salve.
Yeah, I actually, there's some on it right now.
Did you get in salt water?
Oh, what?
Did you get in the salt water?
Yeah.
That doesn't help your eczema?
No, it's the sun. Oh. I don't know. It's completely, there's no rhyme or reason except for when I get like any sun and this year I hadn't gotten much sun, I guess. And there it is. But this is the other thing about that, Sunset Lake Sabade mm-hmm. salve. This is not an ad for them, incidentally. It is great for kids, mosquito bites.
Oh, now we know.
Yep. I mean, Saul was freaking out. I don't know what it is about kids, but they get so many mosquito bites and he got the the dreaded knuckle bite, which is of course the worst. And I was, you know, I tried to put toothpaste on it because that's like I wasn't smart enough to bring any like afterbite or anything like that. Toothpaste, that didn't work, and the salve really helped. All right, let's get to this. As you may have heard, Joe Biden, by the stroke of a pen, like we all knew he could, got rid of $10,000 of student debt for households that are making less than $250, two earners, $125 per person. If you had Pell Grants, which means that you came from a household making less than $60,000 annually, you can get up to $20,000. Also, in many respects, just as important, there are reforms to the loan system as it exists now. There is going to be a cap on the amount of your payments, cannot exceed 5% of your disposable income, and they are increasing what constitutes non-disposable income. In other words, required payments, essentially fixed costs. There's also a cap on the amount of years in which you can pay. You can be stuck with debt, which will cap at 10 years, depending on the amount. So if you have $12,000 left, I think, after 10 years, gone, $12,000 or less. Not sure what happens if you have more, but I imagine there's some step down in that as well. And if you, as long as you maintain payments, my understanding, and I need to read into this more, is that there's no more interest that will accrue on your debt as it is now. But I will double check that. It's hard to get a full accounting of some of those reforms. So all that said and done, it has been wildly popular. Pull out today, or I guess yesterday, or sometime over the weekend. Where is it? Here it is. This is a poll that came out, I guess it was 3 days ago on Friday. This is from Emerson Polling. When asked about their support for loan forgiveness, 36% think the $10,000 cancellation is too much action. Okay, fair enough, 36%. I don't know that George W. Bush's approval ratings ever dropped below that. I don't know if Trump's ever did. 35% think it's just the right amount of action, but 30% more think it's not enough. So you have 65% who are in favor of at least $10,000 being canceled. You have another 30% who think it's not enough. So this is wildly popular.
And it's reflected in Biden's approval rating.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, every poll has Biden skyrocketing back up into the 40s, which is good news for Democrats electorally. It's in their interest.
We'll play the Marco Rubio clip and where he is trying to backpedal on this as well, because his race is now in play. But here is Ted Cruz, not up for reelection, I guess, at this year, talking to Michael Knowles. This is from his
Verdict with Ted Cruz.
It's
his
podcast.
His podcast.
That there is a real risk if you are that slacker barista who wasted 7 years in college studying completely useless things, now has loans and can't get a job. Joe Biden just gave you $20,000. Like, holy cow, $20,000. Maybe you weren't going to vote in November and suddenly you just got $20,000. And, you know, if you can, you know, get off the bong for a minute and head down to the voting station or just send in your mail-in ballot that the Democrats have helpfully sent you, it could drive up turnout, particularly among young people.
That the barista has a job, though, Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Literally in your example. It's inherent to it.
I love this idea of stoners who are on top of their mail-in ballots. Like, that's a nice little image of people who smoke.
Well, it's also sort of fascinating because it shows there is absolutely nowhere for them to go. I mean, they are going to try and drive this resentment about folks with student debt. 45 million people in this country have student debt. That is, of the adult population, you're talking about 1/6, 1/7 of the population, and they all have friends or parents or children. And so it is a really extraordinary attempt. I think what it shows is there is no response for them for this.
Nope.
There are attempts to say this is going to increase inflation. There's not a serious economist who believes this because it's not an injection of new cash, particularly at this moment since we've had a moratorium for almost 2.5 years. And so there is no real argument against this other than it should be more generous, or we should be talking about other forms of debt that exist as well.
Yeah, like professional debt for truckers and things like that.
Well, there is a decent amount of vocational debt that will get, because there are folks who get degrees at these 2 or 4 year colleges that can be laid up. But yes, there's a whole host of other things that we could be talking about in terms of debt relief, but they can't argue that. And so it is to create this caricature of young people. And I would also argue that when Ted Cruz goes on and talks about people who are dealing with this type of debt, that they're just losers who aren't trying to do anything other than to get high on their bong, I guess, he's also going to drive some youth turnout out. Well, I mean, at one point, it catches up with them.
It's easier to caricaturize people when this isn't, as you say, affecting literally everybody in this country, at least indirectly. And Ted Cruz knows a thing or two about not working hard. I mean, Cancun Cruz, right? He has the gall to talk about people not working hard when he jetted off on his vacation in the middle of the state's extreme.
He was escorting his family out. Would have done the same thing, Emma.
I know.
So brave.
Next time he goes to Starbucks, Ted Cruz is in for a rude awakening. Next right. barista he encounters. A exactly. little surprise in his cappuccino.
Yeah, let me just take this in back and put the special sprinkles on it.
And can you imagine if the media... If the media represented those percentages of who supports it and who is against it, if that was representative on like... Meet the Press, for instance, how bad a shape they'd be. But the media basically like acts like they have a real argument.
Well, the poll that I read off, I mean, everyone is characterizing those numbers as if like, you know, it's a close call, but it's not a close call. The fact, I mean, and we saw this also with Biden's, you know, with Biden's numbers, like in general, you will see the mainstream media, the corporate press, make assessments that if Biden's approvals are falling or something like student debt relief is not a clear-cut winner, that the problem is people in the middle are having misgivings. No, it is people to the left who want more action, more of this, not less. 65% of people are either agree with $10,000 of debt cancellation or believe it is necessary but insufficient. That is what is not being communicated because it cuts into the narrative. All right, we got to take a break and hear from a couple of our sponsors. We will be talking more about the student debt relief as we go. I think in like a week or two, I may debate some libertarian about it. I don't know if he still wants to do it now that it's a fait accompli, but I would love for more libertarians to come out and talk about how they don't want to do that. This is good. Aura is one of our sponsors today. I've talked about Aura before. You've heard me say it. It's an app I use to protect my data from hackers, scammers, and spammers. Every day I get an email from like from a different company saying like, we never contact you. So, you know, but people get stuck with phishing scams and all sorts of different things. And of course, data breaches all the time. What are you doing to protect yourself? If the answer is nothing, then I highly recommend you try Aura. Here's how it works. Aura continuously monitors the dark web. They look for your emails, your passwords, and social security numbers, and they send alerts fast to your phone or your email, or both if you want, when they find anything that is a little bit dicey. Aura also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone's opening a loan or a credit card in your name. They automatically send requests on your behalf to data brokers to remove your information, which helps reduce the amount of spam and robocalls you receive. This is a added bonus, ladies and gentlemen. And their antivirus software will block malware and viruses before they infect your devices. Look, identity theft is so common, there's a new victim every 14 seconds. It costs the average victim over $1,000. I can't remember which one it was, but one of those one password companies just got breached. Something like 30 million of those. And you never know if it's yours, but it's easy to find out. You can protect your family and yourself from identity theft right now at Aura.com/majority. When you sign up, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial, and you can see for yourself which of your email and passwords or that combination have been compromised. As soon as you put it in, they'll come back and say this site. And then you can also be like me and find out sites that you signed up for 5 years ago and completely forgot about it. But it is a free trial. So check it out. You sign up, let us know in the comments if your personal information has been compromised in any way, how it helped you out. You will not regret checking. As soon as I put mine in, and I have multiple emails, but I have basically 2 or 3 emails that I use for this stuff. And bingo bango, I found out which ones I needed to change. And some passwords I changed overall.
By the way, it was LastPass that got hacked.
LastPass?
Not one password, which I may use.
Okay, LastPass. I mean, I don't know if one site is better than others, but the point is that the stuff is not secure. You need a backup plan, and that is Aura. Aura.com/majority. Aura.com/majority. Try Aura for free for 14 days. And also, speaking of insurance, I've said this many times, the best time to look for people to hire is when you're not hiring, so that you get a sense of what's out there. And the best place to do that is ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, especially right now, and particularly this time of year. Kids going back to school, blessedly. Luckily, there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. It's a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Like I said, that place is ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter does the work for you. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site. This is based on the G2 satisfaction ratings as of January 1st, 2022. Wouldn't imagine that's changed very much. Look, it's super easy. They have a great interface that organizes all of them. You can rate your candidates. You can set up notes for yourself, set up interviews. It is really a fantastic service that I've used myself. Right now, try ZipRecruiter for free. You can go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jamie Martin, assistant professor of history at Harvard University, author of The Meddlers: Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Economic Global Governance. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jamie Martin. He's an assistant professor of history at Harvard University, author of The Meddlers, Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Economic Global Governance. Welcome to the program, Jamie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with what the prevailing narrative has been in terms of the, I guess, the encroachment on our sovereignty. We had Slobodan, I can't remember his full name, but we, I know you're familiar, you cite the book actually, but we had him on it and talk about the rise of neoliberalism in the wake of basically the, of World War II and Bretton Woods. And on some level, this is your, you are maybe extending the timeline where some of those issues were existing. But let's just start with that prevailing narrative, and maybe to start with, it was Quinn Slobodan. Thank you. Start with just maybe a little remedial, but what is Bretton Woods? Or what was it, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944 was an extraordinarily significant moment in the history of the world economy, in the history of international order in the 20th century. It was a moment at which representatives of 44 countries met in New Hampshire to essentially rewrite the rules of the international monetary system and to create two brand new international institutions, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, obviously institutions that continue to exercise extraordinary power in the world economy today. So this story of the coming of Bretton Woods has long been narrated in terms of the rise of U.S. global power, of the kind of emergence of the United States out of a previous era of isolationist retreat, ready now to undertake more burdens than ever before in providing global public goods and upholding the liberal international order. And there's, you know, there's a lot to this story, but I think one thing that it fundamentally misses is that the IMF and the World Bank were not the first international economic institutions. In fact, there had existed previous international economic institutions for several decades before this point. So Bretton Woods doesn't kind of emerge out of nowhere, as it were. Bretton Woods is kind of more like the midway point in an older history of these attempts to use new kinds of international power to govern the global capitalist system. Now, in terms of the narrative now about institutions like the IMF and the kind of interventionist powers that they wield, this story tends to get narrated in terms of the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system. So the idea here is that in the wake of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, the IMF and the World Bank are kind of, they're almost out of a job. The original system they've been created to defend is no longer in existence. And so they gradually get wielded for this new project of neoliberal hyper-globalization or something like that. And they begin to enforce these kind of neoliberal and austere reforms around the world. And again, there's a lot going for this narrative. I think in its basic shape, it's correct. However, I do think that we need to also backdate that story, as you mentioned, because long before this point, in fact, as early as the early 1920s, international economic institutions were doing something that looks very similar to what the IMF would be doing at the end of the 20th century, using this incredible leverage to get sovereign states to commit to austerity at home or to undertake quite painful domestic reforms.
All right, so let's go back in history, and then we'll follow that line through. I mean, it's almost like I guess maybe different, not quite. It seems to understate the case a little bit to say different wrapping on the same sort of like a product. But the evolution, what you're talking about is there is an evolution here that starts. The story starts earlier, and so let's talk about like what. When did that story start from like the rise of, I guess, nation states? Because when we get into the 1800s, you know, we're not, there's just not as many, or maybe really, you know, the early 1800s, there's just not as many nation states as it were. Talk about that period where that, where we enter into the era of nation states. Yeah. And then really when there is a sense of like, we need to have a little bit of coordination here.
Yeah. So I think really the kind of important beginning point or the kind of backdrop to the history that I tell in my book is the 19th century and really kind of around the middle of the 19th century and particularly the second half of the 19th century. So this is a period of time, as you mentioned it, that sees kind of growing number of nation states in the world economy. Certainly by the end of the 19th century, you see a period of enormous economic globalization and integration. The emergence of new technologies like the steamship and the telegraph allow for the exchange of goods and information and people around the world kind of at a greater clip than ever before. You also see a kind of transformation and expansion of empire in the second half of the 19th century. So by the turn of the early 20th century, kind of when the history told in my book really begins to take off, you see this situation in which you have this highly globalized and highly integrated world economy in which European empire has reached an unprecedented degree of power and influence around the world, and where many countries that enjoy formal legal sovereignty nonetheless begin to see more and more encroachments on their domestic realms by powerful external actors, empires as well as private actors. And this includes the United States, as well as European empires. So this is the kind of, I think, crucial backstory to the history that I tell in my book.
What was the earliest iteration of something like that? I mean, you know, like for me in that era, the reparations that Haiti had to pay France to the slave owners seems to be like one of those, I mean, one of these sort of early, I guess, arrangements between theoretically two independent sovereign countries.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good point and very important context. I mean, Haiti in many ways is a paradigmatic case of a state that wins its sovereignty and independence, but nonetheless sees over time increasingly intrusive forms of foreign interference in its domestic affairs, not only by France, but also over time by the United States, that of course, you know, it even invades Haiti later. And Haiti is a particularly glaring and powerful instance of this and the injustices of it. But many states over the 19th century and into the 20th century enjoyed this condition of wielding and possessing formal legal sovereignty, but not seeing it actually translate into real autonomy and self-determination, whether political or economic self-determination. You see this playing out across the Caribbean, in Latin America, in Asia, in the Middle East, and elsewhere. So this was a kind of widely shared condition of sovereign inequality.
Is Cuba and the relationship with the United States also a good example of that, especially at the turn of the 20th century?
Yeah, I would say Cuba absolutely is an instance of this. I mean, a state that, again, kind of wins its independence, but nonetheless, you know, is increasingly under the thumb of the United States.
So does the run up to World War One, when you have the Allies basically saying, like, we need stuff for the war effort, essentially, is that the beginning of like an understanding of where we can create a world body, as it were, or, you know, certain partnerships or, you know, a cartel, I guess, and our ability to extract from other countries will be greater? I mean, is that basically the beginning of this?
Before the First World War, there had been various attempts in trying to get countries to cooperate over various technical matters that were relevant to international commerce. So trying to get states, for example, to standardize measurements or to deal with questions about rivers that crossed national borders. But these efforts, these kind of technocratic internationalist efforts, were generally limited to matters that were deemed to be, quote unquote, non-political, or at least that didn't incite a great degree of controversy. So, for example, you do not see before the First World War any real international institutions dealing with questions of tariffs, because tariffs are enormously controversial domestic political issues. The important transformation that takes place during the First World War is you see the major Allied powers, Britain, France, Italy, and then the United States, really teaming up to create these international, these wartime international bodies that actually exercise real power, that exercise power over questions of global shipping, over the exchange of raw materials and food and energy resources and weapons. And at the end of the First World War, there's this real question that the Allied powers face. What are we going to do with these wartime bodies? These wartime bodies clearly have allowed us to exercise this new kind of power over the sinews of global exchange. And are we going to dismantle these at war's end? Or are we going to somehow transform them into peacetime international bodies? So this, I think, and you know, this is what I argue in the book, is really, in some sense, the real kind of birth moment of actual powerful institutions of global economic governance, not of these kind of, you know, relatively weak or at least kind of inconsequential internationalist efforts that had existed before the First World War.
So when by the time we get to the League of Nations, the idea is we're not going to use this is an attempt to dress up the idea of using coercive power, and instead we're going to sort of like codify these dynamics where we take sovereignty. We're going to put it into almost a legalistic framework.
Yeah. So the League of Nations, I mean, the League of Nations, you know, for a long time, it had a very bad reputation of being a very ineffective institution. It didn't prevent the coming of the Second World War. It's kind of seen as a bit of a laughingstock, you know, in the history of international cooperation. But actually, in certain realms, it ended up being very powerful. And in the realm of finance, it developed quite significant and unexpected power. So in the early 1920s, just a little context here, many European states are undergoing extreme financial instability, hyperinflation, kind of almost complete breakdown of their domestic financial systems. And suddenly the League of Nations, this new institution, looks like it might be able to help, right? And it kind of steps into the fray. The problem is that there's only really kind of one model out there for getting states to try to get their domestic financial houses in order. And this model comes from pre-First World War imperial arrangements. Kinds of credit, highly coercive creditor arrangements that had existed in the Middle East, in North Africa, again, in the Caribbean, Latin America, and elsewhere, which had seen the creation of these debt commissions that essentially allowed representatives of European and American investors to kind of boss around these states, really tell them how to run their domestic financial systems, kind of to exercise power over public assets and sources of wealth. And when the League of Nations in the early 1920s is looking around for, again, for models for how to, you know, get countries like Austria or Hungary or Greece to get their domestic financial systems back into place, these are the models they have on hand. And so what they end up doing is essentially repackaging these earlier forms of financial imperialism and trying to convince states that they were doing something new as an international institution. The problem is that not a lot of states end up believing them, essentially.
And are they doing this? Are they attempting to impose this on member states, or is it states that are outside of membership? We should remind people the United States was not a member of the League of Nations. Yeah. Congress refused to ratify, I guess. And they did it presumably for sovereignty reasons.
Yeah, I mean, one of the very important reasons why Congress rejected the possibility of U.S. membership in the League of Nations is because of deep anxieties among Republican members of Congress that the League of Nations might actually be able to develop the power to tell the U.S. How to set its tariffs and how to deal with questions about immigration, and particularly restrictive migration rules concerning Chinese and Japanese immigrants, these kind of profoundly racist immigration restrictions. So there is a sense in which this it was precisely this fear of a league becoming powerful in economic realms that played a role in the U.S. rejection of the league. And to your other question, yeah, the league develops these powers over member states. And it's this very fact of membership that is held up by members of the League of Nations and defenders of the League of Nations as a key difference between what the league does and what empires do. Empires exercise coercion over other states for the kind of narrow strategic and economic interests of empires, whereas what the league, at least theoretically, meant to do is it's meant to help its members out. And members, you know, sometimes only by dint of their membership are supposed to accept the sometimes highly disciplinarian nature of this help because it's supposedly accepted freely. It's not being kind of forced upon them. Again, the problem is that over time, fewer and fewer states believe this story.
And I mean, all of this, I think if people recall some of the most controversial aspects of the TPP or of, frankly, of NAFTA, of some provisions of the investor state dispute system. I can't remember the exact words for it, but that is the same dynamic that we're talking about. I mean, this is also the same dynamic in many respects of what they're talking about at Mount Pelerin is this idea of like, having control of the economic realm, essentially, and having that transcend nations' borders, I guess, or sovereignty in that regard. But who is the they here? Like, who, like, when we're talking about the League of Nations and prior, who is the they that are trying to impose discipline? Is it just like three or four, you know, are we just talking about like England and France and maybe in Italy at that point, or who else would it have been?
Right. So, I mean, one of the things that is true about the League of Nations, just like any multilateral institution, is that there are powerful actors on the national level that exercise, you know, great influence in what these institutions do, though they usually aren't able to completely dictate what these institutions do. These institutions kind of develop a certain life of their own and their own ideas and their own kind of standards. However, it is certainly, or it was certainly the case that at the time, the British Empire exercised extraordinary influence, particularly over the League of Nations financial activities. The Bank of England was a key player here under the very powerful and influential governor, Montague Norman. But it's also important to note that, as you mentioned, the United States was formally not a member of the League of Nations. However, powerful American financial institutions played important roles in shaping and providing capital for some of these League of Nations bailout schemes. So it wasn't the case that the United States was fully absent from the League of Nations. It just wasn't, the U.S. government wasn't officially a member.
How much does having multiple, I guess, poles of power within the context of an organization like that, mitigate some of the, I guess, the most exploitive endeavors, I guess. How much does it, you know, I imagine that U.S. finance is not really pumping the brakes upon, like, you know, whatever austerity policies that England and France want to impose on other nations at that point. But, you know, theoretically, these nations, all of their incentives or agendas are not always aligned. And that must in some way inhibit, I guess, like, you know, the point of this, which is to transcend the sovereignty of other countries. Because if everybody, if the most powerful players can't agree on how they're going to go about doing that, that will inhibit it, right?
Absolutely.
Or theoretically? Okay.
No. It's absolutely on point. I mean, one thing that you see happening, or two things you see happening over the 1920s, is that first, you see this kind of slowly but significantly developing resistance among member states to accepting these bailout loans that come with demands for domestic austerity and central bank independence and these other politically painful reforms, particularly states in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. They say, we don't want the League of Nations loans if they come with these strings attached. But the other thing you see by the late 1920s is increasing competition actually between Britain and France over financial stabilization for European states. And I won't go too much into the weeds here, but one thing that's very important in this context is that France is attempting to cultivate and deepen its security alliances with various states in Eastern Europe. And it really, by the end of the 1920s, gets anxious about the role that a League of Nations that's overwhelmingly dominated by the British, about the role that League is playing in these allies. And France actually steps in and says, you know, we're gonna supply loans directly. And when this happens, it deals a very significant blow to the financial power of the League. Now, one thing you see happening in the 1940s, it's almost as though the U.S. state kind of learns the lesson that if the U.S. government, which is clearly the most powerful kind of government in the world by the end of the Second World War, if the U.S. government doesn't singularly dominate the new international economic institutions like the IMF, that something similar might happen, that these institutions may end up being used for ends that don't kind of neatly align with U.S. interests. And this remains, you know, a significant problem, certainly for critics of the IMF today, the fact that at the end of the day, the United States still exercises veto power over the major decisions of the IMF.
And I want to move up into these organizations and sort of and what the implications are of this history. But why wouldn't the U.S. bankers, let's say, in the you know, in the era of the League of Nations, wouldn't they have a competitive edge over the League of Nations and I guess the I guess they called it the Bank of International Settlement was sort of like the arm of the League of Nations? Wouldn't they have some type of competitive advantage insofar as that they may not have, particularly when you're talking about Europe at that time, like, we just want a VIG, you know, we're not terribly interested in, we don't care if, you know, if there's a rise of Austrian power or a rise of, so be it, for the most part, unless maybe they had some other interest there, that might be threatened. But largely, it seems to me that this would be a competitive advantage. We come in, all it is the interest rate. We don't really care what you do as long as you pay.
Yeah. Yeah, and this plays out in certain cases. So, for example, when Poland is seeking out a loan in the 1920s, Poland is experiencing similarly extreme financial instability and inflation. It desperately seeks to avoid kind of accepting a conditional loan from the League of Nations, in part because of security concerns, because by this point, Germany is a member of the League, and the Polish government is, you know, terrified that one of the prices of assistance will be these territorial concessions. So U.S. banks kind of swoop in and say, hey, we're not going to make kind of, you know, attach the same strings to the loan. You're going to have to pay a higher interest rate if you want to deal with us, but we're not going to get our hands dirty, so to speak, with the kind of details of European foreign policy and strategic competition. So it does happen in certain cases.
All right. So, and I think, you know, I think this audience is somewhat well versed in sort of like the implications of particularly, I mean, although there's some, I guess, some reformation that's going on as of late, but really when we're talking about, I guess, really the starting in the '70s and the '80s and the '90s in particular, it feels like an IMF loan was very much oriented towards changing the behavior of the lendee as much as it was about getting, you know, making money on interest. I mean, to the extent that it was really about different ways in which we can extract or open up portals for extraction or sales from the United States and maybe a couple other countries. So what does it tell us that the history of that this dynamic preceded Thatcherism and Reaganism and preceded the ideas that and those ideas were at least developed or refined, you know, in Mont Pelerin in the mid-40s, and you know, made their way to Chile into the 70s. And then, I mean, what does it tell us that at least this dynamic of using this as an international body, I guess, pre-existed? I mean, because I feel like it's always been the case that if someone's going to lend money and they have any other agenda there, it's not just about the interest. It's going to be, this is a measure of control that I have.
Yeah. So I think there's at least two kind of important takeaway lessons of the history that I tell in the Medlars for the questions that you just raised. One is to see how this kind of very unpopular and controversial power that institutions like the IMF are able to exercise today over the domestic policies of member states, to see just how old that is, and to see how at the moment that the very first international economic institutions were being created, that this power kind of emerged almost from the get-go. And what's significant about telling this longer history is I think that we can see very, very clear continuities from 19th century empire up to the IMF today. Now, this is a metaphor that's used a lot, right? That the IMF is kind of exercising powers of financial colonialism or is complicit in climate colonialism and so on and so forth. But one thing I want to suggest in the book is that this is more than just a metaphor, that this kind of interventionist power really is kind of at its core a legacy, a direct legacy of older imperial arrangements. So for those critics, this provides, I think, a kind of, you know, historical details to really show just how powerful that metaphor is.
No, I mean, it also to me shows how when you move into the Cold War era with the way the IMF is wielding its power in Latin America, for example, it also shows how anti-communist politics and Cold War era politics are an extension of colonial era politics. Mm. It's the same kind of wielding of power.
Yeah, absolutely. And throughout this interwar period, you know, well before the actual Cold War, one thing that continually props up as a, reason to endow these institutions with powers is to fight this kind of, you know, fear of Bolshevism, to prevent the kind of global march of Bolshevism, which at times was, you know, clearly exaggerated as it was during the Cold War, but nonetheless was a real fear. And this brings up another point I wanted to make about the kind of significance of this history, which is that I think today there's a lot of, dare I say, nostalgia for the Bretton Woods system and for this kind of early Cold War moment in which institutions like the IMF were seen to be upholding this kind of, you know, more humane world economy than the one that would come into existence later in the 20th century. This was supposedly a moment at which states would be encouraged to rejoin a multilateral world economy, but they weren't going to be bullied into committing to austerity or to raising interest rates in the middle of a recession. They were supposed to be given more breathing space to run experiments with Keynesianism and New Deal style policies. But I think that this situation didn't apply for most of the world, that this kind of description of the kind of golden years of the world economy and of the Bretton Woods system at best only applied to a small handful of relatively wealthy countries in the global north. And that if we kind of, you know, want to think critically about the IMF today and the future of global governance, it's important to move beyond that kind of, you know, desire to return to a golden era of the 1950s. I think this is inhibiting some kind of real reckoning with this imperial history and these legacies that I talk about in the book.
So, I mean, let's talk about that reckoning, because is the concern that if we look at that era through rose-colored glasses, for lack of a better description, and don't see it for what it was, which was at the very least, only beneficial, like you say, for a narrow few subset of countries, or I guess one could argue with a dynamic that may not have been perfected or advanced in its sort of extractive capabilities, or maybe that was also a technological issue too at the time. The dynamic was more or less set there, that the formula was there. It just wasn't necessarily being as, wasn't as, you know, vigorously applied, or maybe just it couldn't be for various reasons. That the danger is that we return to those structures with the expectation that it's going to be better than it actually was. Or is it ultimately that what we need to do is really have a reckoning with just the idea of an imbalance, an inequality of economic power between nations?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of all of the above. I think that I'm a historian, so I'm, you know, naturally somewhat hesitant to make, you know, to kind of offer my own detailed blueprints for reform. But one of the things that I see as my job as a historian is to try to kind of unsettle some of the assumptions that guide kind of contemporary political discourse. And one thing that I see that increasingly I've tend to think of as somewhat unhelpful is this idea that only if we can kind of recapture the unique genius of John Maynard Keynes in the 1940s, and only if we can kind of recapture this moment of, you know, Atlanticist internationalism and New Deal enthusiasm, that we can get a fully cooperative system of global economic governance. And I'm just profoundly skeptical of that view. I mean, the 1940s was a moment of nearly unrivaled U.S. global primacy. It was a world of empire. And it was a world in which the profound inequalities and hierarchies of the global economy were taken for granted. And the IMF was designed with these assumptions and these realities of profound imbalances in global power in mind. And that's why I think, you know, having a kind of ambitious and kind of open-ended conversation about what the governance of the global economy in the 21st century will require needs us to kind of think for ourselves, as it were, to get away from this idea that the mid-century offers us clear lessons.
Jamie Martin, assistant professor of history at Harvard University, author of The Meddlers, Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Economic Global Governance. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. Just got an IM. I'm disappointed you guys didn't spark your lighters during the Tim Pool music video in tribute. Did you guys play them?
Oh, we did. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, I missed everything last week. Missed all the good stuff.
Yeah. Well, we have time to catch up in the fun half.
Well, and of course, I'll just, you know, just have a night of just listening. When does the album
just
come
watch
out?
It. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole rest of the album cuts are going
to
be really good.
I can't
good.
Wait for that stuff to drop, man. I am just sitting here bated breath.
We could do a lyric by lyric breakdown.
Finally put my notifications on for iTunes, Apple, whatever.
Yeah.
It's on the iTunes charts, number one in alternative rock. So, I mean,
is it really?
It is. Yeah. And, I'm looking forward to like the B sides. I've been torrenting the B sides and it's taken like 3 weeks, but, hopefully someday I'll be able to hear those.
Sam, were you an Offspring fan at all at any point?
The Offspring.
The band? The Offspring?
I have no idea what you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, because the only reason I asked...
A little bit after Sam's
time. That was 90s, though.
Yeah, it's
because... It was more late 90s, early 2000s.
The only reason the drummer for Tim's band.
What was the song?
Like they did
Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
Their drummer was fired for refusing to be vaccinated, and he's now Tim's drummer.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
And the Offspring, it makes sense, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Kids Aren't All Right, I think, was their other good song. But it's funny, the post-millennial Andy Knows website has an article on how this got in number two on another chart, maybe the main charts for iTunes as well. So selling a lot of records. But there's this funny quote. I'm not going to be able to find it. It's... I'll talk about it in the fun half, but Parada basically had to leave because he had a doctor say he shouldn't get the COVID thing because of some sort of immune system, but he wants to make it show nobody should have to take it. But should we do plugs now?
Oh, yeah, we should. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You get tired of talking about that that band. You can become a member of this program and help this show survive and thrive.
Yeah, sorry, I found the thing I was looking for. Working with Pete Parada and Carter Banks on the new album has been a dream come true, Poole said. The first song I ever learned was from the album, first album I ever bought, Americana by The Offspring. When I heard that Pete was fired over his inability to get the vaccine, I knew instantly that The Offspring had made a mistake, both politically and in terms of market opportunity. I like that quote because it doesn't say musically. Like,
right, yeah. Market, there was a huge market opportunity for me here, and of course... I can make the statement that this guy, wow. Oh, and it's a band. He's a drummer.
Oh, yeah. Musically, it's a great opportunity, too. So all three things, politics.
I wonder if he had a drummer before this, too.
Tim?
I wonder if Tim fired his original drummer because, like, I'm sorry, dude. You wanted to get vaccinated, and you're not really offering me the commercial potential I needed in this moment.
The drummer brought a whole bunch of new ideas, apparently.
You gotta love
not tell.
Gotta love the creative process.
If you were the drummer that got fired from Tim Pool's band in order to make way for the Offspring drummer, reach out to the show. Email us at Majority Reporters.
That's a good point.
People are also talking about he stole some lyrics. Is that right?
Well, some lyrics? There's a lot of bad lyrics.
There's a plagiarism thing going on with Tim Pool's aggregation website that just posts news, and apparently some of the aggregators haven't been doing a whole real job of rewriting the articles as they should have been.
Interesting. So, I mean, come on.
You know, write a check.
The one of the lyrics is staring at the heartache in your soul as your heart falls to pieces.
Staring at the heartache in your soul as your heart falls to pieces.
We determined that the heartache had metastasized from the heart into the soul.
Yeah.
And now the heart itself is actually breaking.
Physically shattering.
Oh, so the heartache migrated from the heart into the soul.
Into the soul.
Have you ever had heartburn? It feels like it's outside your heart. Yeah, it's all over the place.
If your heart is lost, the heartache, that's when it shatters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's all desiccated. From the heartbreak.
You have to, right.
It's in the soul now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, on some level, that's pretty profound. Like, the heart can't exist without
the heartache.
That was our
take as well.
Congealing the heart.
Yeah. The heartache has to remain.
Some say heartache is what keeps the heart together.
Yeah. So now you got no heart and a heartachy soul.
Of course, if someone said heartbreak, what happens if your heartbreak actually leaves and goes to the soul?
Also, the music video is an interesting
soul break.
Look in soul break. The music video is an interesting window into perhaps his mindset behind this because it's all about trying to close doors so a woman can't leave, and then she ends up leaving and gets into a car accident and dies because that's what happens.
They saved a lot of money by having a house that's probably going to be demolished in a few weeks. They're just filming that. And so it's like this old house and they have an argument and she leaves and he gets door slammed on her, but she learns what happens when you leave.
You do not leave Tim Pool or you'll get into a car
accident. Don't leave this empty, cold house.
Jesus. Folks, again, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out our merch. I think we still have a couple of the limited edition.
And Majority Report
shirts.
I forgot to keep plugging that after day two.
And, of course, we got these bad boys.
Oh, yeah. Those are nice.
As I take an awkward sip from it, because I really should be doing one of these.
There we go.
Although sometimes I use my left hand.
But if you use the other hand, then you see, is it matching your the shirt you're wearing today? Almost.
No, it's a long sleeve.
Oh, okay.
Also, don't forget, you can get the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. You can IM the show with the app at majorityapp.com. We're also working on upgrades to that app coming out soon. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, for Left Reckoning patrons, I talked to Joshua Kahn, Russell about ayahuasca and the medicinal and political implications of such a medicine. And also tomorrow, Tom Winter, we're talking about Montana on Left Reckoning. It's Montana Week. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get that.
See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked. What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Keen.
You did it. Unpacked. Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports.
We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.